Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yuggera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Noonuccal, Quandamooka peoples, Yugambeh peoples as well. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. Welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, beautiful day, blue sky, sunshine, all great. You wouldn't be dead for quids, would you? It's lovely weather. A little cool. Hey, we've still got to get these westerlies hitting us yet, haven't we? Because the Eckers starting, isn't it, this week or something? And the westerly winds usually hit us. Once they hit us, once the Eckers out the way, well, that's goodbye winter for Brisbaneites. Not that we have much of a winter. But anyway, all good. Let me introduce my guest. Diana Eads is an adjunct professor at the University of New England, studied linguistics, and has worked in a range of areas and worked here in Queensland for some years, and we'll get her to talk tell us about it. But Diana has just released a book, Aboriginal Ways of Using English. And we know everything that happens in the English-speaking world is all in standard Australian English, and we know that First Nations people, my mob, we don't, the majority of us, biggest percentage of us, don't speak standard Australian English. Sometimes it's called pidgin, sometimes it's called Aboriginal English and different sorts of things. But Diane's book is about Aboriginal, is titled Aboriginal Ways of Using English. And because it's a great title, it's a great way of framing it, because you don't feel good about Aboriginal English. It's not Aboriginal English. It's our way of using English. So, Diana Eads, talking to me from Armidale. Welcome to the program, Diana. How are you?
Thanks, Tiger. I'm very honoured to be on the program. Thank you.
Thank you for giving us your time and me talking about cold up here. You'd be able to tell us more about cold in Armidale, wouldn't you?
Quite a bit. I think it was -2 last night here.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yes.
So great to be in sunny Queensland.
Well, it's lovely and sunny here today too. You just don't want to go out without a few sweaters on yet.
All right. Tell us a little about yourself with your linguistics and then working with Aboriginal people.
Yeah. Well, I studied linguistics in Canberra in the early 70s, and I got really excited about all the Aboriginal languages in Australia, and I got the opportunity from quite a young age. I think I was 19 when I first started working with people who remembered some of the South Coast New South Wales languages, the Dharawal and Dorigo languages. I did a little bit of work on that, and then we're talking about the early 70s, and then I worked on the Gumbangi language on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. I worked with a wonderful old man there, also a Tiger, Tiger Buchanan, and he taught me Gumbangi language, and the work that we did on that is now used in the schools in the North Coast regions, which is, you know, really, really great. But then when I moved to Queensland in the late 70s, about 78 I think it was, I felt a bit uncomfortable about the way that linguists were going into communities and saying, you know, we need to document your language. I had some interesting lessons about that too in New South Wales. But so I put the word around that I was trained in linguistics and would, you know, like to continue working in some way in research with Aboriginal languages. And I was approached by Michael Williams, who was starting to do the oral history work with his mob, Goringoring mob, and also some Waka Waka as well. And so I worked with him on that, on some of that research. And we were trying to document bits of the language, but also there were ways in which it was hard for people to actually talk in front of a white woman with a tape recorder, especially when a lot of things they used their lingo for were the kinds of things you might want people to understand. Mm. So there I was with a wonderful supportive mob interested in me, involved in the research, and letting me come along to all kinds of great family events and camping, fishing and all kinds of things, and listening to people communicate. And it was listening to people communicate that I realised, hang on, there's a lot going on here. It sounds like English. Often it sounds, you know, pretty well like English, but there are different kinds of things happening with the communication. And so that's how I got involved in studying communication initially between Aboriginal people in that area of southeast Queensland, and then that from there went on to intercultural communication.
All right. So the book, this book now, Aboriginal Ways of Using English,
mm-hmm.
What brought that about? What was it that...
I think you could say it was nagging that brought this book about. Aboriginal Studies Press, they're based in Canberra, they're part of IATSIS, Australian Institute of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Studies, and they were saying to me for several years, the Aboriginal Studies Press was saying, look, you've written stuff over a long period of time that people find useful, that students, you know, should be learning about, but you've written it in all kinds of obscure places. Why don't you put some of this stuff together and we'll publish it? And so I did that, and I wrote a new chapter and brought together old chapters and updated old chapters and wrote little text boxes in the chapters to bring things up to date. So my main audience was students at university and year 11 and 12, but also their teachers. But also, you know, you'd like everyone in the world to read a book when you write it, and I'd like people who are involved in intercultural communication, non-Aboriginal people particularly who are involved in intercultural communication with Aboriginal people, I'd like them all to read it.
Yes, there's certainly some great stuff. I haven't had a chance to read the book, but just to look through it and glance at different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
What are some of the key things with First Nations people and the Aboriginal language? I mean, you can look at courts, you can look at hospitals. I mean, I spent a bit of time in hospital not so very long ago, and it was so sad to hear an older lady, she must have been every bit of 80-odd, Italian lady, couldn't speak any English. None of the nursing staff could speak any Italian. And it was just outrageous the way that she was spoken to. They just kept on talking in English to her like, you know, she should understand, but they couldn't understand her. So it's not just First Nations people, but in this particular instance it is. It's First Nations people and the English language. And we find ourselves in hospitals. We find ourselves in Centrelink offices or whatever they're called these days. All the institutions, courts of law and stuff like this.
And police interviews is an important thing. Employment interviews. And look, I think that... a lot of people, you know, are bicultural or bidialectal, we might say, and can switch and they can use, you know, a more standard kind of English in some situations, and then they, you know, talk very much in an Aboriginal way in their own interactions with their own mob. But, you know, not everyone is, just like the old lady you mentioned, not everyone's bilingual. And I think it's particularly hard in those situations where... people think there's communication going on, but actually there's all kinds of miscommunication. I think the example you gave, it happens with Aboriginal people too in remote areas in your own state and in lots of other places where even if they know a bit of English, non-Aboriginal people communicating with them, particularly in those institutional contexts, probably think, oh, you know, he's saying yes, he must agree with me, he must understand. But actually to understand the complex things that people are talking about and sometimes the technical terms and all that kind of thing. You know, there are all kinds of possibilities for miscommunication. But, you know, even where Aboriginal people are speaking English as their first language, there can be some classic miscommunications, even with a single word that gets misinterpreted, or more broadly, with the ways that people are allowed to communicate. And that sort of gets into issues about the way that communication goes on.
Now, still we're seeing the system's quite slow. They don't really recognise across the board. There might be some pockets, different states or different regions might have interpreters or translators or what have you for our mob. But generally speaking, because we are what they call Australians, we should be able to be, you know, the services cater to our needs, but it,
yeah,
it doesn't.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And I think that there are, as you say, there are some pockets where there's that recognition. The area that I've been involved in, you know, in the most in the last 25 years has been in the legal process. And look, I have to say that, you know, miscommunication can have, as you know, huge effects on a person's liberty. So it becomes very important. Look, I think there's increasing understanding among some in the legal process, particularly among judges, some judges and magistrates and lawyers. I'm not so sure about the among the police, that even though it sounds like English, we might be misunderstanding. There are different ways of using English, and we've got to really make sure we can understand. And, you know, sometimes it's not... I mean, sometimes it looks like an enormous problem. Sometimes I think it's as simple as people understanding, non-Aboriginal people understanding, if we slow down, if we respect that there are culturally different ways of using silence, this whole thing might work a lot better. And, you know, that's one thing that I'm always talking to people about when I do training.
All right. Mm. You talk about working with the law. In the book, you mention a local woman here, Robbie Kiner's case.
Yep.
You played a key role in...
I don't know about a key role, but I was one of the people involved in her appeal. Yes, that, and I mean, that was a pretty sad story. I guess your learners know, your listeners know about the fact that...
I don't think many of our... I think most of our listeners may not know.
No, they may not know. Okay, so perhaps I should just give a very quick rundown of what that story was about. So this was an Aboriginal woman in her 30s. She was from the Sunshine Coast, around up around Gympie, actually, and had lived in Brisbane a fair bit as an adult. And she stabbed her very violent partner in what was considered to be, you know, an argument. He was actually coming for her with a chair raised over his head, but he had a long history of violence. She stabbed him and he died, and with her sobbing, don't die, etc. She was found guilty of murder in a very short, I think it, up to that point it was the shortest jury trial in Queensland, and she didn't give any evidence, and there was almost no evidence actually called in her defence. She pleaded not guilty, but it was a very short trial. Now, the jury never got to hear the story about why she'd picked up the knife as he was coming towards her. The jury never got to hear the background. So those issues about provocation and self-defence were never presented before the jury. Now, she was in prison then and doing a life sentence with hard labour. Now, she would have been there for the rest of her life had it not been for a very thoughtful Four Corners documentary that was actually looking at the difference of punishment between women who kill an abusive spouse and men who kill an abusive spouse. It was quite a good program. One of the main people they featured was her. They interviewed her in the prison. Now, it was very striking when I was watching that. And in the prison, she told some aspects of her story about why she had picked up the knife and what had happened. It was, as she told the story, it was clear to me that in the interview that the media did with her, she had used long silences in her interview. You know how you can tell that, is that the interview goes as a continuous interview, but there are all these jerks where her head is in a different place. So they've edited out long pauses. Well, that was pretty striking to me straight away, that that would be a typical way of many Aboriginal people using, telling their story in English. It's the first language, her only language it was, first language and her only language. And but if she's going to tell an important and a difficult story, she's going to have a lot of silence and pauses while she thinks about it. And the, obviously, as I was watching it, I could see, well, the journalists must have respected that in order to get her story. Now, at the same time, other people were listening and watching that documentary. The Attorney General at the time contacted her in the prison the next day, as I understand it, and invited her to apply for a pardon, or recommended that she apply for a pardon. Now, she went through her lawyers. It became not a request for a pardon, but to have the conviction quashed. And Andrew Bowe was the lawyer who then worked for that appeal. and he contacted me. Sorry, this is getting to be a long story.
No, it's all fine, yeah.
Okay, so he contacted, in fact, I think I contacted, anyway, we had contact. I had the previous year published a handbook through the Queensland Law Society called Aboriginal English and the Law, and the things that I was recognising just from that brief TV interview about the obvious evidence about the silence in that interview, long silences, not many pauses, long silences, that was also things I'd written about for lawyers in 92. So I was then asked to provide an expert report for her second, for that appeal against the conviction. That was the appeal against the conviction. And the grounds of the appeal were that from the lawyers had set up, the grounds of the appeal were that her own lawyers hadn't got her story and were unable to defend her. And, well, the good thing is that she was successful in that appeal, that the judges recognised, and there were three grounds on which that the appeal was successful, and one was related to, now I have to get this right because I focus on the linguistics, but one was related to the way that victims of trauma don't always remember everything, and one, there was another social work psychology grounds. The ground that I was prepared the report on was that the evidence that I was able to gather made a strong suggestion that her lawyers didn't know how to communicate with Aboriginal people, and the pressure that they were under to get, you know, they were legal aid lawyers working under tremendous pressure, the pressure they were under to go to the prison, get her story, get answers to some questions, come back and prepare her defence, they never got the chance to hear her story, while at the same, in the same time period, she was telling her story actually to a counsellor who was writing things down and who encouraged her to write things down. The sad thing is that those things were never, you know, taken up by the lawyers. But so she had the story that, and she knew what it was, and she was able, to say the grounds for why she had to get the knife, etc. But her lawyers never heard it. She was never defended, and so that was an important issue about communicating people with people. It, in my sociolinguistic report, it wasn't about particular words. It wasn't about accent. It was about a few key things, and one was that communication, how you enable a person to tell a difficult story, and that whole issue around the way silence is used and interpreted, and also about how many non-Aboriginal people interviewing Aboriginal people, particularly under pressure, they don't wait for the answer, and there are reasons about that, we can talk about that, but also they often frame questions in such a way that it's very easy to get people just to say yes, but yes mightn't mean I agree with what you're saying. It might mean something like you asking me all these questions. If I keep on saying yes, somehow we'll get through this interview and we can sort it all out later. And, of course, in the legal system you can't.
When you say they don't wait for an answer, elaborate on that for me.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting thing. For me, if there was one thing that I'd like people to learn from this book, you wouldn't need to write a whole book about one thing, but there are other things in there, is that there are cultural differences in the way that people use silence and interpret silence. So, you know, silence always sounds the same. It doesn't matter what kind of English or even French or any language you're speaking, silence is going to sound the same. But just because something sounds the same, it doesn't mean it means the same. And in fact, what we know from a lot of linguistic research around the world in Anglo societies is that the standard maximum tolerance for silence in most interactions with Anglos we're talking about is about 1 second. So what that means is where people are having conversation, it might be people who know each other well, it might be people who've never met before, it might be informal, it might be formal like an interview. If there's more than one silence, by the time you get to about 1 second, often much sooner than 1 second, someone's going to say something, even if you've asked a question, for example, you're waiting for an answer. If the person doesn't say anything like, let me think about that, or you know, gives an answer or whatever, then Anglos are socialised as we're growing up, subconsciously usually, that the conversation isn't working somehow, and then you repeat the question or you say something else or you jump in. Now, that's all very fine, but that's not universal. Now, there are societies in the world where that doesn't work. Japanese society, I think, is one example. Some of the Scandinavian societies are another example. Now, what we found in Aboriginal societies around Australia is that people often are comfortable with much longer silences than 1 second. Not only are they comfortable with them, but they use them, I'd say, productively. That means that's part of the way that a conversation works and works well. So if you've got people who are used to waiting, used to having pauses while people think about things before they speak again, and you've got those people trying to tell their story to someone who's raised to think, oh, subconsciously, I think these things are by and large subconscious, to think, gosh, you know, this person isn't going to answer this. They're shy, or they don't understand, or I've embarrassed them, or you know, they're stupid or whatever, and then starts again. And I think what we see quite often in interviews, really, is that Aboriginal answers are interrupted, and it's the silent part of the answer that's interrupted.
Yes. In talking about Robbie Kiner, Robbie's a local woman around here, as Diana said. She passed away a few years back. But I think she served some 5 or 6 years before that conviction was...
I think she did. It was a very sad and terrible thing. But also it was a very successful appeal, and a lot of very good things happened through that. And, in fact, the day after that appeal, the then Attorney General made a press release saying that the legal system has to pay attention to cultural differences in communication. So she actually did an important thing there. I mean, she suffered terribly, obviously. She suffered terribly at the violence.
In the relationship, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely horrific what she went through. And then, you know, absolutely re-victimised by the legal system. But to have the courage then to go through with the appeal, et cetera, and to teach the legal system a lesson that they took very well. I mean, of course, some people will take decades to move on and to challenge their thinking, and maybe they won't, and then they'll retire. But a lot of people did really take that lesson to heart, I think.
Mm. This is not an isolated case. It's still happening 20, 30 years later.
Absolutely, yeah.
On regular occasion as well.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a real worry, isn't it? And all the kinds of, you know, that's one thing that I've learnt through linguistics, and when I talk to, when I run workshops and so on, I try to show people a way of understanding communication through a bit of a linguistic background, which is that there are lots of things that we take for granted that we assume are about a person's personality. She's shy, or he's ignorant, or she's pushy, or whatever. And they may often be about different ways of using the same language.
Yeah. But yeah, and you often hear, oh, they're shy people.
Yep.
They're shy people.
Yeah, I hate
shy
that.
Be buggered.
Yeah, huh? I hate that.
We ain't shy.
Exactly. But do we give you the chance to tell your stories?
Exactly. That's right. Yep. Yes. No, it's just this cross-cultural business or... yeah, the communication.
Yep. You know, Robbie Kiner said something really interesting to me when I was talking to her in the prison. She said to me, yeah, there's lawyers, you know. She said, they asked me lots of questions, but they didn't want the answers.
Mm. Mm.
And I think I can see why she said that. I think they really wanted the answers, but they had no idea that they needed to wait for them.
Right.
And one of the things that sums up what the lawyers were thinking, so I'm not into lawyer bashing, and I think the lawyers that worked on that case had a very difficult job. They were working under incredible pressure, and a really bad thing too with the way the legal aid system was set up then, dealing with the pressure, is that every time they needed to get a bit more from her for her case, they sent a different lawyer. Now, how can you tell a really painful, difficult story if you don't have particularly for Aboriginal people, if you don't have a connection with the person who's trying to, you know, it's all about connection. But anyway, what one of the lawyers said was she was such a poor communicator. So can you see that, you know, both of them are attributing an intention and a weakness to the other side. She was saying they asked the questions, they didn't want the answers. And they were saying she was a poor communicator. And I think a lot of that revolved around neither of those things, but
exactly.
Around different ways of using English. So it's things like that that, you know, have driven me to keep on going with this work, and I think that drove Aboriginal Studies Press to nag me. And, I'm glad they did, by the way.
Yeah, yes. On I find a small paragraph here on one of the pages, and when you're talking about the justice system, you mm-hmm. say, is our justice system interested in a fair go for Aboriginal Australians? Or is it a one-sided game where the cultural assumptions of the dominant group are taken as facts and where verbal trickery can be used to mangle and distort the evidence of witnesses and prove them to be liars?
Mm. Yeah. I still ask that question.
Exactly. Don't we all?
We all? And, I think we do have to be to strike out when, I've been doing this research for years and I've got evidence that makes me ask that question. We do have to strike out and put the questions right out there. And at the same time, or soon after, or at a different time, we also have to acknowledge that there are people within the justice system, some very senior people within the justice system, who are interested in the fair go and are trying to work around those entrenched system things that really do prevent... quite often prevent a fair go. You know, and one person who was important in that dimension, if I might mention, is, Tony Fitzgerald. He was the Chief Justice of the Appeal Court that heard Robin Kiner's appeal. His judgment is a very, powerful condemnation of aspects of the way that the system was working in her case. But some years before that, before he was a judge and before he did the Fitzgerald inquiry into police corruption, he was actually the senior barrister on Kelvin Condren's case, which was a case that I also worked on. And that was the first time I met him. And I was very impressed. You know, I'm just talking about an individual here, but the system also has individuals, and there are, important individuals who are, through their careers, within that flawed system, really working to make things work and to make things change and to educate people. And, he was very enlightened there in Kelvin Condren's case in the mid-80s about issues about Aboriginality and identity, language and so on. And that was a really important thing.
All right. Let's take a break for a song and come back. Now, I'm very fortunate to have joined by Jeannie Bell, one of our leading linguists from our own mob. And it's great to have Jeannie call in. And Jeannie's reminded me, I saw it earlier too, and I was trying to get a hold of you, Jeannie, that you wrote a foreword for the book. So, Jeannie, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Tiger. Really good to hear you talking with Diana about these kind of issues because they are so important,
They certainly are. So, Diana, we're very fortunate. We were just talking. I asked her to send me the contact details for Jeannie, and here she is. She just contacts me herself.
Hi, Diana.
Hi.
It's just great. So, Jeannie, tell us your mob, your country.
Well, I'm a Yagara mob, from the Brisbane Valley kind of area, through my grandfather's side, which is, the Bonner Bells, and... We're in the middle of... I'm back living in Brisbane at the moment till the end of the year, and I'm getting involved with my Yagara mob, particularly with all the native title stuff, which I always swore to stay out of, but, I am helping a bit, particularly with the language stuff and just keeping up to date for my family, really, and on behalf of our grandfather Stanley Bell. I'm doing linguistics too myself, working here, talking to as many people as possible, many Aboriginal people as possible who've got a connection to Cherbourg, really, is where I guess one of my focus areas is around kinship and marriage and section systems is what we call it. But looking at it through Aboriginal languages, it's a lot more complicated than that, or a bit more complex, but, that's enough for people to know. Yeah. But obviously, I have a great interest in Aboriginal English, as, Diana knows, and I think we all do. But one point I just wanted to make really was just the focus on Aboriginal English really is about, the different varieties around Australia that exist across the country, you know, and a lot of the Aboriginal English spoken in many places, including places like Brisbane and Sydney and Melbourne, you know, everywhere you go, you will hear people mixing in language words. And I think that's one of the major things that Diana highlighted when she wrote her thesis many years ago at Queensland Uni on this is how we talk in Southeast Queensland. That's probably not the absolutely correct title, Diana, but, you know, I think that we all realise that there are different, well, as linguists we do, but in the community it's always good to let people know that the different stages of language that evolve over time and change, and, you know, no language is ever stagnant, including Aboriginal English. So there's a lot of mixing up.
I think that's
up.
Really important. That's really important, Jeannie. Yeah, in fact, the title of my thesis all those years ago was English as an Aboriginal Language in Southeast Queensland.
That's right, yeah. Which is a very important document that people still refer to. I know, as you know, that Robbie Kiner from Batchelor Institute, where I work, is working on Aboriginal English, and, you know, I think people refer to that document a lot still. So,
well, they won't have to read that document. They can just read this book now, Jeannie.
They can read the book. Well, I'm sending a copy of your
book. PhD thesis, but the main...
I'm sending a copy of your book to Robert Nova, sorry. Yeah. I said Sister Girl's name by mistake. Tiger, and also just to correct you on that, she is a Dunedin person from the Kilcoy area. The Kiners are very much connected to Grandfather William Mackenzie from that area. And of course her family's still very involved in stuff that's going on up there in terms of, you know, their native title claim and getting their land back. So
I'll
let Diana talk. My point was really just to point out that there are variations in the way people use Aboriginal English. And it is a linguistic term. It's not a term that, you know, you go around saying to your cousins in your mob in town, oh, I'm speaking Aboriginal English, you know. We just do it naturally. And, you know, I mean, it's this whole thing about linguistics and, you know, language in the community is, it's quite sort of, it's connected, but it's you know, separated too, because the study of linguistics and languages is a very, you know, removed thing from how we use and speak language every day. We're not conscious of all that.
Yeah, look, I think that's really important, Jeannie, and particularly as you've highlighted, you know, that it's not the same all around Australia, and that it's connected very much in local areas, and that, you know, the local lingos, even if they're not being spoken right through, they do come through in the English.
They come through strongly,
Or, you know, the way, as you say, people don't use those linguistic terms, but in the way people talk,
Jeannie, who can make most of this book from through Black Eyes? Who can make use of this book most? Like, who is this most relevant to? Or
I think it's really relevant to teachers in the schools today, because, like you said, Tiger, nobody's really taking this stuff seriously, and Diana's been on about it for many, many years, as have I, and as has E. Fiesel, the other linguist from Southeast Queensland. You know, I mean, there's many, many people. Western Australia's kind of done quite a bit on it, but we're in Queensland. I think it's been one of those situations where people just go, oh, you know, they've got to learn to speak proper English. But they are speaking proper English. They're speaking them as in us, the Aboriginal mob. We're talking how we talk naturally, you know.
Yes, it's proper for us.
Yeah, it's proper to us. Yeah, proper English.
That's such a good point. And
teachers, particularly in the primary schools, when kids are first going to school, they need to be given that kind of acknowledgement. Well, we understand that this is your home language, and we understand that that's the language your community speaks. We'd like to just, you know, also introduce some, you know, aspects of standard English, as in, you know, I don't know what's their actual goal of standard English is these days, because, you know, Australians don't speak very much like the way people spoke 50 years ago today, not even 20 years ago. You know, when we went to school in Brisbane, we had to learn grammar, and, you know, we had to learn how to speak like, you know, good English speakers and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure, you know, you both can, you know, connect to that idea, because that's how we were taught. But, you know, today the kids just, they speak in their own dialect of English in the classroom, in the playground, but it's different again when they go home to their cousins, or they're around their mob, you know, in the park at Musgrave or whatever. You know, we're all speaking that way. But politicians, obviously, through the bureaucracy needs to be a little bit more conscious of it. And, you know, Diana focuses so strongly on the judicial area, and I did a case for her recently. I mean, she asked me to do a case that was happening in Cape York, and I've never followed up to find out what happened to that poor woman. But, you know, I think that that whole thing of getting it through to the justice system is one of the main things. You know, as we know, this young fella from Cherbourg who's been arrested for that terrible crime that happened out at Logan, and I'm not, you know, connecting him to it because nobody knows yet if it was him, but I think he desperately needs help with language stuff in terms of support when the lawyers start going through his case, you know, because he's so young and he, you know, it's just one of those situations. Again, this miscommunication thing would be happening, and if no one is there to kind of guide the lawyers and give them some input, and it doesn't need to be a linguist, it just needs to be somebody who knows that, you know, this young fella, when he says that, or when he, you know, says, oh yes, I did it, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know enough about the law, but I think that people like him, and I'm only picking him out because it's the most recent case, and like you said, Tiger, it's still going on today, you know.
Definitely.
So police, I think they need to have that focus, and they need to know about it as well, because I don't know what kind of cross-cultural training they have when they're getting trained to be police. I know there was always somebody from the community in Brisbane going to the academy and doing cross-cultural training.
That's right.
And does that still happen? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure at all. But it brings this question then. We have our own legal service. Some of our legal services have our own people acting, those lawyers and stuff. But these solicitors largely are non-First Nations people.
Yeah.
They would not know these signs. So our own services need to be, I don't know, mindful or, I mean, do you see this as being a problem, Jenny?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it all gets lost in the mix, doesn't it?
Because it does.
With the, you know, with the situation with the legal services, their funding's always kind of, you know, under threat, or their, you know, lawyers come and go and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I guess somehow it does get a little bit lost, but it does certainly need to happen. I mean, people do need to know that when you're talking to an Aboriginal person who's maybe hasn't finished high school, you know, maybe hasn't even finished primary school, and they've spent a lot of time in their community and they're, you know, very immersed in their community and family, they may not be speaking English the way you speak it, you know, as a lawyer.
And you know what, when the police officers and so on hear a whole lot of just yes answers or even nodding head, they often think that's communication going on. But it mightn't be communication at all. It might be that, you know, thing that we call gratuitous concurrence, and technical term, but meaning, you know, saying yes or nodding, but not meaning I agree. But white people say, well, he must have understood, he said yes.
Yeah.
That's right. It's so easy, isn't it, to dismiss it? I mean,
It is. And, you know, the basic thing at the beginning of a police interview is that people have to be told their rights. And I've worked on quite a few cases where, you know, quite recent ones, in different parts of Australia, where the way that the rights are explained, the police officers, I think, I see the videos, I think they're really trying hard to explain it, but they haven't been, they don't realise that they're still using big words. We've given you certain rights, they say. What does that mean to someone? What did you give me? Mm. I didn't see you hand me anything. You know, what does that mean? You know, so I think that right at the beginning, those questions are very important.
Jeannie, the young fellow you referred to in Cherbourg has been questioned about a crime at Logan. How does, you've identified an issue there. You're saying from your observations, there needs to be some intervention here.
There does.
How does that take place when somebody like yourself makes an observation? How do these people get served fully and appropriately?
Well, I guess I observed it, and I'm kind of had thought about, you know, we've got to do something, And I was going to talk to Mary about it, Mary Graham, because I know that, you know, she's, Aunty Jean Phillips had spoken to her about this particular situation. And I saw him on the TV again last night and I went, oh my God, you know, we need to do something to help. And I'm not saying we're trying to, you know, change whatever the situation is, but we need to support him in terms of his interviews because, you know, it's just...
You know, everyone has the right to a fair interview.
They do, and they need to have, you know, the two cases you've mentioned and those young, that other case, the Pinkenbar case,
yeah,
Diana.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
look what happened there, you know?
Yeah, exactly,
I mean,
exactly.
They're only still... He may be 18, but he's probably quite immature in terms of his understanding of how justice systems work, you know, and how quickly that can become, you know, totally unempowered to do anything. And he's, you know, hoping that the lawyers are going to do the right thing. But like we've been saying, the lawyers aren't really educated to understand that either. So there's got to be something done, Tiger, and I feel like I must do something, but I'm not sure what I do. Maybe Diana would have some advice.
Well, I think the first thing you do is you contact the lawyers and say, you know, how what's in place to protect this person's rights in an interview.
Yeah, okay.
So that's the very first thing. Now, and in various cases that I've been involved in over a number of years, lawyers have tried to get... and sometimes it works, get evidence before the court about the communication patterns that the person uses and any difficulties that they may have experienced in interviews that have already happened or things that might be able to facilitate the person, their rights to tell their story in interviews that are still to happen. So that's issues about communication and the rights, your rights, but that all has to happen through the person's lawyer. Yep.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, and I should have thought of that, and I guess I probably did know it, but I didn't. I haven't acted on it yet, Tiger, but I think it needs to happen.
Good on you. Listen, thanks for calling in, eh?
No worries.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jenny. Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Diana, for being on the air, and we can hear you up in Brisbane.
Sunshine.
I know. Well, yeah, I'm sitting in my car in the sunshine. And, yes, it's great to hear you back on air, Tiger, and, you know, we're all thinking good thoughts for you and lots of positive energy. Okay.
Thank you very much. You have a great day. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Jeannie Bell, a local, I think, Jagera woman, she said.
And a very highly respected linguist in the linguistics world, I have to tell you too, Tiger.
Yes. No, she is. And it's really great that she's called in. I've got another caller on the line. Welcome to Let's Talk. Who have we got?
Auntie Lilla here.
Auntie Lilla, how are you?
Good. Hello, Jeannie. Hello, Diane. It's wonderful to hear you.
Hi, Auntie Lilla. It's just wonderful to hear you. And I've acknowledged you at the beginning of the book.
I haven't seen your book, but thank you for thinking of me, Diane.
As I said, my two 1980s colleagues, Lilla Watson and Matt Foley, who first drew my attention to the legal relevance of my research into Aboriginal ways of speaking English. I'll never forget the day you came and said that to me.
Thank you very much. But I want to say it's wonderful to hear you both. But I want to say, you know, for a long time I've tried to talk to people in the legal service to say that Aboriginal people going to court need interpreters in an urban situation as well as out in the, out in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to talk to people about that and I haven't got anywhere. But, Jeannie, I think it's wonderful if you could go to the lawyers and talk to them about this. It'd be a wonderful thing to happen for Aboriginal people in urban situations to have interpreters when they go to court.
Yeah, we don't have Jeannie with us because we've only got the two lines.
One thing about that, Auntie Lilla, is I'm wondering if we need to use a different word from interpreters because...
Yes, Diane, you might come up with a much more appropriate word for that.
Yeah, because the only thing is if we say interpreters, then I think a lot of people will get in their mind that every single thing the person says, you've got to say in standard English. And
yes, I see what you're saying.
Where the Aboriginal English sounds often quite like the standard English.
Exactly.
And not everything needs to be interpreted, you know what I mean? And people might start laughing at that and thinking, sort of trivialising the issues. That's my only worry if we use the word interpreter.
That's a good point.
Yes, no, I understand what you're saying, and perhaps you could come up with a more appropriate word. But we certainly need someone in there with the Aboriginal people who are going to court so that they understand fully what is being said to them and they can answer in a, answer back.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were saying people were nodding and the police take it as agreement, really all that's saying is people really, aren't they? They're saying, I'm listening, I'm listening.
Mm-hmm.
And and what else do you have to say? And they're taking that, in a absolutely different way altogether.
Yeah, and even it's when the person asks a direct question, where the answer would be yes or no. And lots of people lots of non-Aboriginal people would say, I don't know. But what I see in a lot of interviews with Aboriginal people is that they actually say yes, where even it might be contradictory.
Absolutely.
You might see from the rest of the interview that it doesn't actually make sense.
That's
know, once you've said yes, they've nailed you,
Yes, exactly. I mean, I have the same problem just communicating here with my white husband. He'll ask me something and I'll say yes, and he thinks it's an agreement. I say, it's not an agreement at all. I'm just saying yes because I was listening to what you said, and yes, I hear what you say. And we end up, he's misinterpreted what I said. But I'll let Tiger get on interviewing you, Di, because... It's a wonderful interview, and thank you so much, Ty, for having Diane and Jeannie on. It was wonderful.
Yes, it was
great.
Thanks,
fantastic.
And okay.
Thanks for your call, Annie Little. You have a good one. Talk to you later
thank
on.
You.
Bye now. Annie Little Watson joining us there also. So it's good to have Jeannie Bell and Annie Little call in with their views. Diana, what keeps you busy these days?
Well, quite a few things, Tiger. So I'm... doing some work on individual cases, and they all seem to take longer than you expect. I also do some training for judges, magistrates and lawyers mainly, but also do a bit of training sometimes for people who work in native title. And the idea is I do intercultural communication training, so I try to give people an understanding about the way to think about communication in English, and then I show them some of these tip-of-the-iceberg sort of situations. But I also have quite a bit of work involved in the broader language and law international community. So I co-edit an international journal and I'm asked to speak at various conferences. And so, I travel to some far away places and I learn about things that are happening in other areas. So I kind of balance those things. I'm not doing teaching anymore. At the university, and I reckon I did that for quite a few years and enjoyed it when I did it, but it's nice to be working on these other things that really need time to be explored and exposed and communicated.
All right. Well, look, thanks for joining us today. It's just fantastic to
thanks
have
a lot, Tiger. I really appreciate it, and I'm honoured to be on your show.
We'll talk again sometime.
Okay, thanks, Tiger.
Thank you very much.
Thank
have a great
you.
Day
Bye.
Now.